Welcome to Upthinking Finance, a podcast that offers a unique and discerning view of economics and financial planning. Here is your host, Emerson Fersh.
Welcome back to another edition of Upthinking Finance. I'm Emerson Fersh.
Doors frontman Jim Morrison once said, "Whoever controls the media controls the mind." Now, I have to think that just about everybody that listens to this podcast at this point is well aware that the media, whether it's online journals, newspapers, television, or social media, is completely disconnected from reality in most cases. And so the challenge for us has become how to discern truth. First of all, where to start with where we're getting our information, how to filter that in and of itself to determine what resonates and what doesn't. And ultimately, I think the key part of this is reconciling these ideas and information we're being presented with our own personal experience. And so that's the challenge we live in. But what's helpful, I've found, is to get to a point of understanding of how all this started, the hows, whens, and whys of propaganda, and how it's developed and evolved over the years. And so we're really fortunate today to be able to have a guest on who wrote this book, One Idea to Rule Them All, which was referred to us by a client of our firm, Naomi, who's out on the East Coast here in the United States. The author is Michelle Stiles. And so the hope is, as we have this conversation, that everybody listening will be able to discern in their own personal lives and see the tentacles of this propaganda machine, whether it's in your own company you work for, the local government you're subject to, or perhaps the religion you're involved with, because I think you're going to find, and maybe a little bit disturbing for some people, just how common these principles are, manifest themselves around us. Now, a little bit about the author before we bring her on. As I said, her name's Michelle Stiles. She describes herself as a lifelong reader and explorer of truth. And so her quest in this whole propaganda issue came up when she was personally subject to experiencing the malevolent evil, as she calls it, that had overtaken the leadership of an inner city school district in which she had volunteered. And so that's where all this began. Now, Michelle, interestingly enough, is actually a physical therapist by profession. She's written a couple of books in that regard, one called Fast Track Your Recovery from a Total Knee Replacement, How to Eliminate Pain and Pain Medicine the Quickest Way Possible, and the other book, Color and Laugh Your Way to Knee Replacement Surgery. She's also the inventor of something called FlexBar, which is a recovery tool for knee replacement surgery. Now, she was once told by a university professor that there was no such thing as a Renaissance woman and that she should cap her Bachelor's of Science in Physical Therapy and Master's of Science in Exercise Science with a PhD in Sciences. Of course, she promptly decided to complete a Master's of Arts in Practical Theology. And if there's anything I love as a person who's told by the establishment to do one thing and they go their own way. Really, to summarize this book, it's really written to expose the realities of the world we live in terms of the role of propaganda and manipulation. And really, it's offered to anyone who senses in their bones that something in the world is off kilter and they can't quite put their finger on the source. My pleasure today to welcome the author of One Idea to Rule Them All, coming to us from Tucson, Arizona, Michelle Stiles. Michelle, welcome to Upthinking Finance.
Thank you, Emerson. It's great to be on with you and your audience. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, me too. So I guess the thing is, the first thing that struck me with your book is, I mean, there's a huge amount of research. I mean, you've just gone, I mean, you cite everything. How long did it take? And is there anything you want to just share with people before we dive in through the process? Because it looks like just a lot of work.
Yeah, well, I got started about 14 years ago, and there was a sort of some local corruption that I saw, and I realized this is a pretty small hill to take. And I wondered, wow, it was the first time it really came home to me how corrupt Washington would probably be because of how much power is invested there. And so for some reason, I just said, I'm going to study propaganda. And I just started reading books. And it was really hard to find anything that was really illuminating. And I kept going backwards a little bit. And then I hit Creel, George Creel, who was the head of the Committee on Public Information in World War I. And his How We Advertised America just, first of all, it's a provocative statement. You know, it's like, and he's, of course, he's doing a victory lap on how we advertise the war. He's really proud of what he's done. And the idea of selling a war just sort of smacks you. It just leaves a bad taste in your mouth. And so, and he's so excited about all they did. And it's jaw-dropping to me. And I kept asking people that I knew, did you learn this in high school? Because I didn't learn this. And really nobody knew. And I thought, geez, we've got to get this information out. And so that took me down the rabbit hole. I started, you know how people do who are researchers, you know, you just look at the bibliography and okay. And then I was going back historically to time pieces written from people in that period. I didn't go to historians talking about that period. I went to the people writing at that time and the people who were telling me what they were doing in their own voice. So I like to call these guys the godfathers of propaganda, but Bernays, Creel, Laban, and Lippmann. And so one represents sort of, Laban is the theorist, right? Creel is the practitioner, the first demonstration, large scale, government organized demonstration project here in the United States. And then Bernays was a kind of a visionary on where this thing could go post-war into the corporations. And then Lippmann was a journalist. So I just took those guys from each different kind of segment and used their own words to try to highlight. And I'm sort of a minimalist in terms of I'm trying to do the necessary and sufficient amount of information that you need to connect the dots. I'm not a historian by trade or anything, right? Discipline. And so I'm not trying to take you into deep dive and confuse you in a lot of extraneous details. I'm trying to take a real high level view of things and expose that longitudinally across basically the last 125 years.
Well, and that's a really good point because ostensibly, I think that's what journalism is supposed to do, is present ideas where people are allowed to come to their own decisions. And clearly that's, I don't know if that ever existed, but you know, it's a lost art. And I think the other thing I wanted to point up while I was listening to you is I did an interview with a woman called, her name's Melissa Shimei. She's over in Northern Ireland. This was probably last fall. And same thing, independent researcher who, you know, we had a great discussion about CBDCs. And that's the thing I think that's also been shifting is getting away from these so-called experts and instead allowing people who aren't afraid to put in the time and the effort like you, you know, to present really an awesome just case. And you can see I've any book that I've read, I've pretty much destroyed. So you can see yours is well on its way to losing its cover. But let's dig in because I thought you mentioned the selling the war. Let's talk, if you can, about this, the World War I, because that to me, like you said, was shocking. It's nothing you learn about. And yet you see the beginnings of what we're all dealing with today.
Right. I mean, Creel was given $6.6 million. So the greatest amount came from a presidential fund. The rest came from about a million something came from a congressional appropriation. So he had a ton of money when you think of it at that time, right? 1917, $6.6 million. There wasn't a channel that they left unutilized to promote their message. So just to start with, they had the hard news, what we typically think about as facts about the war and what was happening over there. Then they had soft pieces. They were distributing these. So they were, in essence, syndicating right across the platforms. And so the soft news would go to places like Harper's and McClure's, right? So these magazines that were human interest stories, right? Then you had a national service bulletin that was targeted toward age appropriate for the schools. And that was launched across the country. You had a pictorial department, which was everything, but you can think of the iconic posters and signs, Uncle Sam needs you, those kinds of things. But they also had wall hangings and things that went in businesses and storefronts. And they got a lot of volunteer service from many of those great artists of the time, right? So in addition to their $6.6 million that they spent, they got a lot of in-kind services from people who, hey, I can't go to war, but I'm patriotic and I'm going to give my time and service instead of being on the front line. They did the Speakers Bureau, right? So they had the 4-Minute Men. So what you're doing there, and it's really sneaky, is you're taking Washington talking points. They would have maybe 1 to 3 speeches a month that they would distributed out through this growing network, 10,000 people strong, to basically memorize these speeches and be able to deliver them extemporaneously to the community. Now, what they were doing there is they were borrowing on the trust that those local people had built up in the community. So this didn't seem like a message coming from Washington. It seemed like a message coming from their neighbor who they knew and trusted. So that was huge. So they were called the 4-Minute Men. They had the Junior Minutemen that mimicked that same thing, but did it at a school and a college level. They even had, and I didn't even put this in the book, but they had a war exposition, believe it or not. And that was Creel. He's got away with words. He called this a cross between a circus and the seriousness of a sermon.
That's actually perfect.
Isn't it? Right? Yeah. You know, because so it was in 21 cities and they charged a nominal fee. And it basically brought the war kind of home in an exposition way to the common people.
I'm going to have to curb my comments because there's so many places we can go and there's a lot I want to cover. But what was the motivation behind all this in the first place? In World War One.
Right. Okay. So definitely the motivation was that there was significant, and this is something that I really didn't know, there was significant opposition to the war. I mean, Wilson was elected to keep them out. He kept them out for his first term. He was reelected to keep them out the second term. There was really, America wanted nothing to do with the war in Europe. It wasn't likely to come to their shores. It didn't seem to impact them. And so there was a real need to galvanize public opinion behind the war because it really wasn't there.
Interesting. And I got to say, just listening to the little part, I mean, it's like, it's so coordinated. I mean, even then, you know, you have this idea of this America. And the thing I got out of it, what you just shared, was playing on the sympathies, people's patriotism, finding their weak spot, vulnerability, I don't know what you want to call it. But anyhow, now you mentioned a few other names that came up during all this. I remember Lippmann was another one. Walter Lippmann, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Kind of maybe walk us through as this thing went on.
Do you want me to jump? Because Le Bon comes first.
Okay,
he comes
right
at the turn of the century.
And okay.
He's the origins of mass persuasion. So let's talk about him a little bit before we
yes
get to Lippmann. Because Bernays and Lippmann are both kind of foot soldiers in World War One, and they spring off of that. But Le Bon is at the turn of the century. He writes in 1896, and it's called The Crowd, Study of the Popular Mind. And it's important to recognize that was translated into 19 languages. So that just sent flares up in the sky for me. Like, pay attention here. Late 1800s. That wasn't easy to translate back then. It's not easy now. You know, you have to pay somebody to do the translating and then print the thing. And so basically what he was saying is he was looking at the time period and what was happening, and that there was real fractures in the Judeo-Christian ethos of the West, right? You had The Origin of Species, you had Nietzsche, God is Dead. And he's standing in the press of the 20th century, and he says, it's going to be the era of crowds. The divine right of kings is out. Okay. People are not going to galvanize behind emperors and monarchies and such because the divine right's gone, right? We don't have that anymore. So the masses are getting a little bit unruly. What was happening in the United States of the late 1800s? You had the muckrakers. People were angry at the capitalists. They were resenting the conditions of labor that they were putting in. They had been dislocated from the rural areas into the cities for the first time. And so there was a lot of unrest and upheaval. And so he said, we're not going to use logic and reason anymore. This is what we're going to do. That's profound, right? It's transformational. He's throwing democratic representative government out the window because he says, we're going to manipulate you in this way. And so some of the things he talks about is appeal to people's sentiment, give them their illusions, repeat things, just affirm it's true. Don't give them any reason. Just affirm it and reaffirm it, right? And say nobody in their right mind believes anything else. And we see that today. I mean, you can read his book and be shocked because it's 125 years old and it fits right into today's time period. But he had all the elements, but they were sort of thrown about in a way that was loose. And I kept looking at that. And the reverse engineering piece of my book comes from Le Bon, where if you say, gosh, if this has staying power for 125 years, maybe, just maybe, he's saying something really important about human nature and how we come to believe things in a community of trust. And when I started to look at it that way and looked for categories, that's when I came up with the infrastructure of belief. So things started to snap into place. And again, this occurred over a time period of 14 years. You know, as I kept studying and looking at this and asking questions and seeing different things myself that started to emerge. He was really, really important.
So I know we're going to get into some of those in a minute. Another principle you brought up was this idea of stagecraft, which, you know, I mean, there's so many different things that stand out, but these are ones that just seem to be kind of foundational and sort of building to where we are now. Do you mind maybe sharing a little bit about that?
Right. So that's sort of Bernays's contribution. And so he's been off from the war, and he writes this little book, Propaganda. And he's trying to rehab the name Propaganda, by the way. But anyways, in that, he talks about teaching new students of PR, because he sort of conscripts that name as the father of public relations. But he says, you're going to have to know what news is and news, what news looks and feels like, because you're going to be, in a sense, manufacturing news. So what you're going to be doing in stagecraft is taking an experience and bringing it in to out of the psychic realm into the physical realm. So we kind of, when I explain infrastructure belief, experience is the centerpiece and seeing is believing. So we orient ourselves through reality, through our eyes. And that just goes way back, right? You can go to Doubting Thomas. You know, people say, I'm going to believe it if I see it, right? And it's highlighted in our judicial system, right? The eyewitness is considered a really important piece toward fitting together the truth of a case, right? Eyewitnesses. So here's what he said you should do. Like, and I'm going to give the politician's example. So he says, all right, you have a politician who wants to lower taxes on the wool imports coming in, right? And, you know, like, why do they want to do it? It doesn't matter why, all right? The politician shouldn't go out and just use logic and reason to get that passed, get a law passed to change that. What he should do is this. He's going to, in one part of the country, let's say on the coast, it's New York or San Francisco, he's going to have high net worth individuals show up at a function in a cotton suit boycotting wool. Now, that qualifies as news. It's highly unusual, right? People go, oh, what's this famous so-and-so doing? Why are they wearing cotton suits? So the press is clued in on this. They report on it. Okay. Now, somewhere else in the country, maybe Midwest, Indiana, there's another group who just have, like, let's say they're middle class people and they have an issue with the wool being so expensive, right? Things that they can't do. And so then somewhere else, he has a social worker do a survey and find out that the poor are freezing to death because they don't have wool, socks, blankets, products. Okay. So what that looks like to somebody's in America is that this problem now has emerged into their consciousness through varied experiences that are sprinkled across their mental scenery of their mind, if you will, right? That's kind of how Littman put it. And so what's happening is they're saying, oh, this is a problem. It becomes to emerge in their consciousness through the experience, right? And that's stagecraft, because really nothing is real about these experiences that they've encountered. They've been manipulated by a public relations expert.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. But okay, so here's the thing. I wasn't going to get into this, but you kind of brought it up. Because,
okay.
No, this is really important, because you mentioned in here about experience. And kind of one of the things that's come up with some conversations, like with John Waters, I mentioned you before, we've had a couple of conversations with him. And what you're talking about is creating experience. And what I'm finding for me and a lot of others are finding, the benchmark to really sift through all this stuff that you get into in the book and what we're up against is your own personal experience. That is, and that, of course, that's a whole nother thing, is how do you discern from manufactured things that have you been fed all your life, right? To genuine personal witness of things that you cannot deny is from the Almighty, whatever, is just truth, pure truth that you build your life on. And to me, that's kind of the antidote to some of this stuff, is because you can, you know, and I'm finding this, and I'm sure you are as well, you look at things and are presenting things, but then the reality of your own witness and your own experiences as you live your life completely contradicts. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think if you go back to the infrastructure of belief, what we haven't fully kind of fleshed out.
Yeah, let's do that.
But that helps. Like, so if you took a number five dice, experience would be in the middle, authorities on the bottom, a social pressure is on another corner, and then culture, imagination, and words that help define the culture and the reality. Now, what's happening is, if you think about a small local culture, you can't know everything. You can't go out and learn everything that the medicine man knows and learn how to hunt and make the tents and do the flower. And so as society becomes more complex and more diverse, you have trusts, right? That you look to say, well, this is what I'm going to believe, right? Experience is number one. And you have a small, let's say early American, most people lived within 10 miles, a 10 mile radius, right? What I didn't see myself, somebody I know saw something. And so the experience is held fairly close. We're not worried about things 2,000 miles or, you know, 2,000 miles away from us or even further, right? So we have a small local culture that's high integrity, right? And so if I don't know the answer to it myself, what's the next thing you do? You look to authorities, right? Let's find somebody who knows something about cars. I don't know the answer, right? So you go to your local authority, and in small communities, if that person is scammer, like a snake oil salesman, he gets routed out pretty soon. He gets identified and he's got to go to the next community, right? So we have this self-reinforcing cleansing of that trust organization, right? And then thirdly, if I still don't know what to do, experience, authority, I'm going to kind of look around me and go, what's everybody else saying and doing? It's kind of like a fail safe. You know what I mean? And most people are kind of like that, right? Aesop's fables, right? The emperor has no clothes. It goes way back, 1400s, right? We're going to just say, we don't want to go out of that mainstream. We want to be the outsider, right? And so you can pretty much triangulate most beliefs not necessarily in hard facts, but experience, authority, and social pressure, in my opinion. Okay. And so, but the problem is, as you get a technological society and those trusts, the news was the indispensable fourth estate to root out corruption and falsehood in politics and places distance from us, but they abdicated that responsibility, right? And they become part of the elite establishment, I would say, right? So who is routing out as you get further and further away from you? Somebody can say, well, this happened in China. We have no way, except for the news, right, to basically corroborate those stories, right? So anyways, as technology gets further and further away from us and we're shown pictures and we're told a story, and, you know, now the internet kind of poked a hole in some of that, right? Because we were being shown, let's say we had somebody with a camera, an iPhone, live on the ground, and we were being shown a different story than maybe the narrative of mainstream media. And that started to poke some holes in their strength of their authority. Does that make sense?
Totally.
So those are trusts. And what you were saying about experience, how do we tell the difference now? It's a real problem. I mean, once this thing has been corrupted, which it has, you got to remember too, and I didn't address this in the book, I may in a future book, but you got to remember the Associated Press was consolidated in the early 1900s. So they not only had a lock on the newspapers, but they had a lock of news gathering, right? If these are the pieces that come in as your news, they're basically, they have the power to deem what's important and what shall be neglected any day, every day, right? So I can select the problems. That's why I call the news treasonous tribal elders, because somebody in our culture needs to be the ones warning. Like tribal elders would have functioned as this group of wise heads who are looking out for the interests of the community, and they're analyzing threats and they're deciding what to do. Our politicians have pretty much abdicated that, right? And I would say the news functions as the tribal elders, because you could have somebody do a speech and they don't even cover it. They don't even cover things that happen in committees, right?
Right.
So they're basically the ones saying, okay, these are the problems we should attend to. And if you have a household and somebody says, yeah, the problems you should tend to, oh, you need to paint outside and you need to fix the handrail here, but you have termites in your foundation and nobody's telling you that, and you go on for years like that, the house is going to be corrupted, right? And so that's what I mean. They're treasonous tribal elders. Who in the culture now, I'm asking you, Emerson, right? Who in the culture now is looking out and highlighting the actual problems, not pseudo problems?
That's the question. Well, you know who it is? It's people like you, like John Waters, like Melissa I mentioned, like Alex Craner, like all these people, like Dr. Tess Lowry over there in the UK, who spoke up for ivermectin during all this insanity with the COVID a few years ago. That's the thing, is I'm looking at the book and I'm looking at this trust your eyes under experience. And I think I'm probably being redundant from my comment before, but you can really look at that two ways. Because to me, it gets to trusting your eyes, but trusting your heart. And some of these basic principles about look at the fruits. And there are just people who clearly you see it say one thing, but the actions go a different way. I've seen that in the work I do. I mean, our industry, the financial services industry, big surprise. There's corruption at every level. And what I'm finding is, as I start getting down to these levels of smaller companies that operate on a different playing field, are actually places where you're starting to get different views and get a break from a narrative. Same thing with religious organizations. It's one thing to talk about principles and living up to a higher standard, but I mean, these are biblical things. If you can't even handle the small responsibilities of the world, which you can't, shouldn't be trusted with the keys to the kingdom to act as a mouthpiece for God. And so I think there's an awakening because, and I guess maybe this is a question for you as a person who's dug into this, you'll find I go in circles with this stuff, but I'm finding that connecting with people all over the world, all over the country, you start to realize, you start to get your own truth from the experiences of others and who are seeing things too that are similar. And then you start building on it and you start to realize the depth of all this. And so that's, I guess, the hope, but that's a good point. People in positions of authority right now, by and large, I mean, I don't listen to news. I can't remember the last time I turned on.
Yeah, I can't either.
Yeah. And, you know, and even like Zero Hedge, I think we may have talked about that. That's a financial blog. And, you know, you go in there and there's certain still things that are, you have to sift. And I think that's my question to you is it because I read this and I thought, my God, are we just trusting souls that are naturally inclined to want to give people the benefit of the doubt?
and have been completely taken advantage of. And so on one hand, it's like, God, this seems so basic in a lot of ways. And yet we've all been just completely surrendered to it for so long. I'll speak for myself. I woke up 4 years ago during the whole COVID. So on one hand, it seems like it's insidious, but we've also given over our free will or our trust so easily. Maybe that's the question, is why is that? And then the other side of it is it simply for money and power? Is that what this all boils down to? The other side of this is why the people are taken advantage of?
Well, it certainly is about money and power. I mean, I think it's always been, right? Because that's as old as the garden, right? But I think one of the things about truth is there's a saying, truth will out, right? And initially, very, very powerful forces are at work to try to submerge truth at this point. And they have a lot of the control mechanisms of the culture, right? So current truth is difficult. It contains a cost to dig up. Like literally, it's a time and sometimes a financial cost. And some people have lost their lives trying to dig out the truth, correct? So there is serious cost to trying to get truth in a live time, all right? Like now, current truth. So why I encourage people to look historically, because to me, the gems are lying on the ground much more easily accessible. They've been dug up to a certain degree. Like, for example, I wrote a blog about Crozier, which is Al Crozier. He was trying to expose the banker's plan to get the Federal Reserve, right? And he was battling against them, and they created a front group called the National Citizens League for the Promotion of Sound Banking. And they say in communications, in a box somewhere in Harvard now, this lady went in and they're saying, yeah, we started this front group, right? So it's there. It's ready to be picked up and carried forward, right? So a lot of the truth has come out. People have dug the work up, right? Historically, and you can gather that a lot easier. And it's non-polarizing. Right now, we're in such a highly polarizing environment. It's almost you can't even talk to people. So what I kind of come from an apolitical position, try to bring people back historically and say, look, so in exposing that Crozier versus the bankers thing, there was a New York Times article that spelled out exactly what that front group was intended to do. And this shocked me because I didn't include it in the book, but it was 1911. And the New York Times article laid out everything that they did in the war 7 years later or so. They basically said, hey, well, first of all, they made sure that the company was corporated in the Midwest because the banker said, if they understand that this is from us, they'll reject it immediately. So hated were the bankers, the Northeast bankers. And so sure enough, they incorporated in the Midwest. It was all Midwest people. But of course, they were aligned with the bank, right? Or the Northeast bankers. And what they did was they had chapters in 42 states. They created an entire network. They created simplified material that would be distributed freely. They used $500,000 or more. They created a speakers bureau. They targeted some things to the populace, some things to intelligentsia. They had books, symposium, and Al Crozier had a book. He was a lawyer. He could diagnose what they were saying in the Aldrich plan, and he was somewhat conversant with financial things. So he basically said, here's section A1 or whatever, and then he gives the interpretation. This is what they're going to be able to do. When you read this book, it's shocking. You're like, we gave the house away during the Federal Reserve, right? And so anyways, he exposes it, but he's got one book, he's got a little bit of money, and he doesn't have much to get his message out because the news isn't going to cover him. That's kind of what we're fighting against too, because how to get this message out, right? We're getting censored on the internet now. And so truth is, it's going to have to come from us. We're going to have to open our mouths. We're going to have to share things and widely distribute because there's nobody else going to help us with this. All the power and money and effort is going to submerge the truth from the top down. Does that make sense? So I encourage people to go back, look historically. If you can see how much propaganda was going on in the 1900s, you can just extrapolate it out. You don't even have to look at that middle section of history and you go, well, of course they've just progressed. Does that make sense?
No, it does.
They never stopped using it. It's just accelerated, et cetera, until most of what we're being told is just a mirage.
And what we're seeing. I mean, you throw onto what you're talking about, and then you add CGI to it.
Right.
I mean, I'm not a techie guy, but I saw a little video about showing a little kid who looks like he's walking on the edge of a fence and going to fall into like a drop-off on the street. And then the real picture is it's just CGI'd, and it's just like the pavement there you can't see because of the altering. And so it's like when you brought up in the beginning in the World War I Ep chapter about the pictures of showing the dead Germans, but not the French, I think. And then that's what I'm saying. And you've articulated, but you start realizing that that has been refined, that ability, you know, this soundbite world.
Oh my God.
You know, it's like, how do you stand a chance?
Right.
If you're completely relying on, as you said here, what you know, trust your eyes. And then you add on, and I've got to go through these real quick, imagination, trust your culture. Right. So you're trusting these people around you who then you jump to this other one that's in here, social pressure. Trust what others are saying and doing. Everybody wants to fit. I mean, I've just naturally been a contrarian. I think you shared that. But somewhere in there, I mean, that's just, I've always gone against the grain just for another reason that it just felt right to not just dive in with everybody. Then authority. So then in this group of social pressure and culture, you've got these people that are put on a pedestal for a bunch of reasons, whether it's their familial relations or their wealth or the power. I mean, it's all the usual stuff, or the letters after their name, whatever it might be. And then you,
celebrities.
Right? Yeah, right. You know, the celebrities endorsing stuff. I mean, I have to tell you, there's a couple other things. Gosh, I'm already half hour into this. I can't believe it. Don't you feel like, and this is the appeal to people who are trying to figure stuff out in their own life, that deep down somewhere in here, I'll say I'm a spiritual guy. That's probably better. But I believe in God, and I believe that God's in here. And I believe that there's this conscience, there's a spirit of truth, whatever you want to call it, that testifies. It's almost like all this stuff has been designed to block us from ourselves. You know what I mean? And because I think deep down, we all know we can see things. And I think I've shared this on other interviews that there is certainly a fear or a hurdle to literally shelving all the beliefs you've ever had in life. You know, I mean, literally starting from scratch. Untethering, right? But when you do that, my wife would say the same thing, and I discerned that from reading your book, is it's freeing. There's a freedom when you get to start over, when you get to start with your own menu. You know, I've mentioned this one last thing, and I'll ask you to just share your thoughts on this, but there's this book, The Four Agreements, and one of the first ones it talks about is this Toltec philosophy. But they talk about, you know, we come into this world thinking we have a freedom of choice, yet the menu's already been printed. We think we're choosing because, you know, I choose to be this religion versus that, or I choose to believe this versus that. But the point of it is it's all still there in a box we're picking stuff out of, you right? And when you can jump outside of that and all of a sudden you're starting completely from scratch, and that almost seems like the extreme that we have to go to at this point, at least to me. And I don't know, does that sound right? I mean, I'm sure there's things that are sacred, but you really got to go to some base core inside beliefs to sift through all this.
Yeah, I think one of the things that helped me, and we are sort of wired this way, but of course it's getting sort of de-emphasized, but wired to see difference, right? So when things come in, and so part of being a contrarian is seeing patterns that don't seem right. So like I mentioned in the book about this Elizabeth Obagi, right? And she was the Syrian expert. And I went, you're like 25 to 30, you're a good looking younger woman. You're not going to be an expert in the Syrian culture. You're just not. Instead of just leaving it and walking away, I start to pull on the threads. All right. So I look up, where is she coming from? Oh, because she's coming from the Institute of the Study of War. Well, that's a very hawkish. I mean, if you look at who funds them, follow the money. It's Northrop Grumman. It's Raytheon, et cetera. And the people at the head of the organization are all retired ex-military. Okay, so then I leave that alone, and into my senses come again the fact that she falsified her PhD, right? It untangled without getting too deep into that story, because it'll probably take us a little while. Things start to emerge. I want to encourage the audience to, things that come up as a pattern that look funny to you, explore. Pull on those threads, because it's part of deconstructing. You know what I mean? Because you can't go down, like you're talking about, starting over and jumping out of the box. You're deconstructing it in part over time. Right? So pull on those threads, things that look unusual to you. Like when I saw coming up on the horizon, I'm like, this looks like a marketing rollout to me, right? Because it was too coordinated. Things just capitulated in a domino fashion outside of real life. Like, think about it. You have like family in for an extended weekend and you want to decide where to go to eat. And one person says, oh, well, we can go over here. Oh, that's going in the opposite direction. I'm going to have to drive home. And another one says, well, how about Chinese? Oh, I had Chinese yesterday. And you know what I mean? And you go through this 20-minute conversation to decide where are we going to go to eat, right? And so in a society with all kinds of conflicts of interest, there should have been a huge dialogue at the direction the country took based on, well, we can't do this for the kids. This is going to be bad for the kids and they're not really a threat here. And you know what I mean? But everyone just like rolled over like a domino. That to me looked highly unnatural. There's no way a society does that unless there's some sort of planning and coordination amongst the super organizations that are extending pressure down to the lower ranks. Does that make sense?
Completely. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So just encouraging people to see patterns, things that don't fit right, pull on the threads, ask more questions. And again, you know, you go back to your idea of the spiritual and asking for instructions, you know what I mean? Seeking knowledge outside yourself. And I talk about this in the domain of knowledge, like there's two domains of knowledge. We've been enculturated to be rank materialists. There's nothing that exists except for like this physical table in front of me, your microphone, et cetera, right? And facts should inform what you do. And in fact, that's not true. We have a whole series of values, all right? And our values come from the humanities. It comes from what is truth? What is man all about? What are his highest goods? How should he orient himself in the world? How should he orient himself through his neighbor? All those things are in the humanities. They're in stories. They're in myths. They're in religions. They're in poetry, right? But we de-emphasize humanities and it comes through hearing. You have to talk about these things. You can't examine the physical structure of the world and come up with values.
Right. Right.
Right?
Yes.
And they have to be talked through. So the domain of truth is in verbal expression. I know that's kind of a deeper concept.
No.
You know what I mean?
You're right. You actually reminded me of something. My son and I went to Eastern Greenland in 2019. And one of the parts of the trip was we went to this island called Tinatekalok. and it was 80 people. And we sat in the mayor's living room. And we're a little tour group. It was this NatHab, so there's a plug for that. But we sat there and through a translator, he was explaining how the history, and I kind of gleaned this from parts of the tour where the Danish, I believe, are the ones that settled Greenland and basically came in with their, you know, the church and effectively destroyed all the culture, their traditions. But what you're talking about, and then of course, now I'm seeing the insidiousness of that because it all gets back to what you're talking about, which is you start disconnecting people from these roots, these stories. I mean, my wife's a quarter Hawaiian. These myths and tales are a part of the culture that help people connect to the world. And so you're right. These are the things that are important. I guess I just come away, like I said, from this discussion and reading this book that, you know, and I've already felt this, but the days of waiting to be told what to do by other people are over. You know, we're done. It is absolutely on each and every one of us to do our own work, to have conversations, to read, and to just navigate our way through. Like I've mentioned before, I just go back to certain things that have happened in my life that can't be explained materially, like you said, that are coincidences, whatever you want to call it, that for me in my life, the hand of God. I mean, my interview with John Waters, the last we had, you know what we found out about 40 minutes in or 20, I don't know, midway through the interview is we both got sober in AA. I mean, this guy in Ireland, right? And so you start to see these connections and things, and you start realizing there is a greater force working here. And that's, you know, again, I don't mean to start preaching, but that to me is where you have, tap into that truth, because then all the rest of it's going to fall, which is where the hope is. Now, I know we're almost running out of time here, but I wanted to ask, because you mentioned in an email, you've done a little research on the American Red Cross. And I just thought, if you've got any things to share, one thing I have learned too, and I mean, these bigger organizations, you know, it's kind of like you said or alluded to earlier, you have to also look at guilt by association. I think when you start seeing these patterns of these organizations, you know, the UN is clearly not looking out for the best interest of anybody. Well, let's talk about most of us, the lower levels of the world here. And then, you know, you connect these companies, organizations, you start to see the connections there. You know, is there anything you feel like comfortable sharing?
Yeah, think about overall, these people are so, people want to talk about light and dark, goodness and evil. The evil isn't original in any way. It infiltrates, it mimics the good. Right. And so they infiltrate good things. Right. And so I was reading it. And again, it was a wonderful book by a gal who had done an extended dissertation on the origins of the Red Cross. And if you go back to the Civil War, it was Edith Barton who sort of started the Red Cross, American Red Cross here in the States. And going into the turn of the century, you see her getting up in age. And it looked to me like that core group, you know, kind of cannibalized her highly trusted organization. Right. There is trust. We could get into something that's trusted by the American people. Right. The socialite Mabel Broadman into the organizational structure. And she ends up turning and accusing Edith Barton of fraud or, you know, like mismanaging the resources. And they were really live time, like, let's get the money to the people. And so, you know, she was probably not quite keeping track, but she was a very honest person, so it wasn't a problem. But she ends up having to go before a congressional committee. It just crushed her in her 80s, right? So she gets pushed out and they incorporate and they become a quasi-governmental organization, right? And the first major disaster that they encounter after she's pushed out is the great fire, earthquake and fire of San Francisco. And so they're sort of like, well, without our lead person, what are we going to do? So they bring some people in from New York and they basically took in all this money and they slow walked it out the door, right? And so they actually gave loans to people instead of charitable gifts. They had ended up having two lawsuits brought against them for not distributing the money in a fair and equitable way at the end of the disaster period. And they were upheld because they said, you know, the people of the United States wanted that money to be charitable, but you've made it like you're making money off of it. And they sat on a whole bunch of it and created the first endowment for the American Red Cross. And what you find a little later on is they create this palatial, and that's their words, building for the Red Cross in the 2 years before the war. Okay, interesting, right? And in the war, Ivy Lee, who's a public relations expert that was used by Rockefeller to kind of paper over the Ludlow massacre, if you remember, the Pinkertons just kind of came in and mowed everybody down. It was a real PR disaster for Rockefeller. Ivy Lee sort of smoothed that over. He gets ceded to the American Red Cross Corporation, and as well as Henry Davison, who was the right-hand man to J.P. Morgan, now is running the organization in Washington. So, I mean, and then there are some other things. I won't get into those, but it's an interesting, and, you know, like recently, American Red Cross has been accused of lots of money laundering and not getting the money to the people. I don't know if you're familiar with a lot of the scandals in some of the major, like the Haiti stuff, and, you know what I mean? People give there and they don't, it doesn't get to the people. Again, you can insinuate yourself into things that are highly trusted, and that's a way to get at money and get at opportunities in other countries. It's something that I'm kind of working on for the next book, actually.
Yeah, you just actually said a mouthful with because the idea of people giving their money, hoping to expect the people, but in turn, the trusted institution having their own ideas about what to do with it and explaining it away.
Yeah.
And become corporatized.
Right.
But the changeover from Edith Barton, and nobody knew, you know, nobody really recognized that. So all of a sudden, it really almost been taken over by hostile forces who didn't have that genuine concern for the people. And now it was an institution. And you can look at, too, if you sit back and look at the war, the propaganda, the PR campaigns, the people themselves were sold the war idea, right? But they were also sold, there were four different campaigns for the Liberty Loans, okay? Liberty Loan 1, 2, 3, 4. They were done in different subscriptions. There was a Victory Loan publicity campaign. There were two American Red Cross campaigns. So not only are the people, because these were bonds, think about it, Emerson, these were bonds. You're investing in a war. How horrific is that? I'm going to make money. Like they were offered 3-5% or 3.5%. I'm sorry. That's just not a good thing, right? You shouldn't be investing in war, right? But people, so they were petitioned to, they had to offer their money. Of course, they're sending their blood and treasures already, right? Now they're being asked to fund the war. Then now they're being asked, well, you have to also fund the Red Cross. So you're going to fund the support for your injured soldiers as well. And at the end, they did a campaign called the United War Work. And that was a combination of organizations like the YMCA and some like a Jewish and Catholic group, but they were funding the troops staying in for an occupation season. So like for a year and a half, they were still stationed in Europe and they were giving them entertainment and things to do to spend their time while they were an occupation force. And the people were asked to pay for each one of those things, incredibly. You know, not only did they lose their lives, but they were asked to do all those things. So we haven't talked about this, but there was huge backlash after the war to what had been done. People sort of realized when wasn't the war to end all wars, right? And things panned out quite differently than what they were told. Of course, people who came back filtered, talked about what happened in the war and the type of trench warfare, horrible warfare that it was. And so there was a huge backlash, a lot of interest in propaganda and what had been done in America at that time. But it basically, in that interwar period, by the time the World War II came around, it went underground because it was so wedded to the image of enemy propaganda. It almost disappeared into the midst. Like, Americans didn't do propaganda after World War II. It was just
the enemy. Communist. Yeah.
The enemy. The enemy did it. We don't do it at all. We've been doing it for almost 50 years now, but we don't do it at all. It's just Germany, Russia, and whoever happens to be the enemy against us at the time.
Yeah, I tell you what, I could talk to you all day about this stuff, because as you're talking, I'm just thinking more and more and more. I mean, even in my work, I've been in financial services now for almost 40 years. And this may seem little, but just the realization, I had a municipal bond manager on, I don't know, a year or so ago. And it never occurred to me that when you buy tax-free bonds, there's a specific purpose to it, building a hospital, fixing the roads, an airport. Government bonds... What does it do? It goes to the government and they do whatever they want with it. Corporate, it's the same thing. And you start realizing, you know, and that's what kind of speaks to what you said. Maybe this is a good place to end, but there is an accountability. People have to start holding these organizations and these people accountable. And it started with people's where they spend their money, where they don't. You know, you start to see these product boycotts and things. But the government, have they earned the trust of just you giving them money to let them do what they see with? Not to me, they haven't. I mean, any of my clients listening to this won't be shocked to hear me say that. But there is an awakening. You're certainly, your book has a role in that. One more time, for those who are watching, One Idea to Rule Them All. You have a website, smartsheep.com.
Smartsheep.com. It's sheep with an E in the end. It's an old English plural.
Yeah. And I guess just last thing, any final thoughts? When do you expect your next publication to come out? Because I'm excited to to dig into it.
I don't really know. I can't put a timetable on that. I mean, still working on other things. I still have a job, you know, but no one's getting this information out but you and I, as you alluded to earlier, right? I mean, it's up to us. No person on a white horse is coming to save us. You know what I mean? And we've got to share with others. We've got to open our mouth. We've got to attend to those things, pull on the threads. But one of the ways that I've endeavored to do this and help people is to, I created a study guide with the book. You can get that together on my website as a bundle. You can't buy it through Amazon as a bundle, right? So you get a little cheaper cut rate, right? And teach your kids, at the very least, sit down with them. I mean, this is made as a 12-week course that you could do. You could lengthen it out depending on your schedule or whatever, but sit down with them. You'll learn as much or more than your kids. And you'll go back in history, you'll understand the patterns. And once you start seeing the patterns, it becomes so much easier to dissect them when they're around you. Jumping into American propaganda as it is right now is a highly complex 21st century absolute weapon they honed down to the finest thread, right? And so it's very difficult to insert yourself at that point and to understand things. You know, it's like saying anything really complicated. You don't jump into college residency with a medical school. And that's what it is. I mean, you're asking people to dissect a propaganda at this point, because there's so many different controlled oppositions and what they're doing on the internet. And you would take an enormous amount of time. Go back to history. It's much easier to learn. It's much easier to understand. And then you can fill in the blanks, and then you're set to start growing in your propaganda IQ for current events, right? It's becoming almost life-preserving to be able to understand and map out the environment, right?
Well put. Yeah. And I would just reiterate something we talked about before we started, and that is, again, the infrastructure of belief. If anybody spends any time, those five things alone, I think, are pretty eye-opening, because you see the threads and the tentacles of that whole kind of structure. You can permeate everything. And once you see that, tie it to the history, right? Like you
and
said.
And remember, yeah, it's not techniques, it's trust. In a democracy, they impregnate and permeate. They get into the trusts. That's what they do. For example, you think, well, I'll just learn logic and reason, and it'll help me from being betrayed in a relationship. Like, you would go, of course it's not. Because why can you be betrayed in a relationship? Because you trust them. That's when betrayal is, if you don't trust them, you don't feel that betrayed, right? You feel betrayed when you trust. And so you got to remember, right and left, Creel said this, it's like, they know how to control one side and the other. Like, I'll just speak your language, but then I'll get my information through you as well as the left side or the right side, right? And so they're not trying to impact the people on the right through CNN. And conversely, they're not trying to impact the people on the left through Fox News. Okay. But they're impacting both sides because they own a lot of the digital space influencing both sides. Let's be honest. You know what I mean? So that's a very hard place to start. So I say, just go back and take it one step at a time, learn it from its foundation and realize that it's the trusts that are being infected. And remember, what was the one thing they went on a late night comedy show? And what was the first thing that they said about coronavirus? They said, we're going to find out. This is a big experiment. Are people going to trust the science? So politicians have no trust left. Right? The news media has no trust left. And so medical doctors and science still had a lot of trust. Now that's really been blown up to a large degree after coronavirus, but they were using that intentionally. So people still trust science. I mean, that's, it's apolitical. It's pristine. There's no agenda there. Just trust the science. And people did.
Well, as has been said, and I think it bears repeating, trust has to be earned. It's not just given. Yeah. And I think, right. Anyway, Michelle, I want to just thank you for your time. Thank you for taking the time to write this book. It's great. And I just appreciate you joining me on Upthinking Finance today.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Emerson Fersh is a registered representative with and securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisor services offered through LPL Financial, a registered investment advisor and separate entity from Capital Investment Advisors. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision. The guest speakers and the companies they represent are not affiliated with or endorsed by LPL Financial or Capital Investment Advisors. Individual tax and legal matters should be discussed with your tax or legal expert. Economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted, and there can be no guarantee that strategies promoted will be successful. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. There is no assurance that the techniques and strategies discussed are suitable for all investors or will yield positive outcomes. The purchase of certain securities may be required to affect some of the strategies. Investing involves risks, including possible loss of principal.